You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A new series of books called The Writer's World includes poetry, fiction, essays, and interviews by writers around the world in which they discuss how national identities, politics, and cultural traditions affect the nature of their work and what it means to be a writer. The first three volumes are Mexican writers on writing, Polish writers on writing, and Irish writers on writing. And the series is published by Trinity University Press. I'm very pleased that it brings series editor Edward Hirsch, the poet, critic, and president of the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation. Also with us are Evan Boland, editor of Irish Writers on Writing, and Margaret Sayers-Pidden, editor of Mexican Writers on Writing. And what a pleasure it is to have you all here.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
And Ed, why did you decide to focus on writing about writing? Is the act of writing very different in different places?
Well, maybe the act of writing itself, but the meaning of writing turns out to be different in different places in terms of its cultural constraints, in terms of its cultural opportunities, in terms of the cultural history in places. And we felt that there were a lot of anthologies that were really valuable, terrific anthologies of, say, Scottish writers on writing or New Mexican writing or New Irish writing, and those were really valuable. But we wondered, what did writers actually think about writing? What did they think about the literary enterprise in different countries? And who were these writers that we didn't necessarily know? And so as a kind of investigation, we started looking into it, and we decided that no one had ever done anything like this. And so we decided to launch these volumes. It turns out there isn't, not only is there not anything like this in the United States, it turns out there isn't anything like this in the home countries either.
Wow. Margaret, how far back did you go into Mexican history to find authors to include?
I went back before there was Mexico. The very first person in the book is actually Bartolomé Las Casas, who wrote to his king. It's just a few lines, but I thought it was appropriate because he wrote to his king to defend the rights of the Indians, that they do have souls. And since so much of Mexican literature has a social tone, I thought he would be appropriate.
And he is highly regarded in Mexico because he was a priest who went against the attitude of most of the conquistadors.
Yes, that is
which
true.
Is that these were subhuman people because they were not Christian. They had to
That's
be Christianized.
Right. That's right.
Carlos Fuentes and Octavio Paz are two Mexican writers well known here, but do you think that despite the fact that Mexico is just across the border, Mexican literature has been largely overlooked in the United States?
I feel that very strongly. And I think that's been part of my life. You know, it's cliche, but we translators like to think that we're a bridge, that somehow we can build understanding between two countries. And I think that's true in this book. If those of us who live in a literary world, of course, appreciate writers. But we should definitely appreciate what they think they do when they write and how it affects them. And, of course, their national situation affects what they do. So they are very different, I think.
Even you don't include any 16th century writers in your collection. In fact, you start with William Butler Yeats and only have 20th century writers.
Yeah, I think that the most coherent way, if you are going to look at it, is where the national literature began, just at the threshold of the foundation of the state. There are lots of other ways of doing it, but that was one way of doing it. And because, you know, Irish writing about writing has no theoretical basis. That's not what the country is. But there's a huge echo chamber as you go from Yeats right up to a playwright like Conor McPherson of these voices in their minds of each other. You know, we have Lady Gregory writing about founding the theatre, but then we've Cullum Tobin many years later writing about Lady Gregory. So you've this big acoustic of a literature talking to itself, which is often the way the writers write on writing.
Although some of the writers you've included have spent or did spend much of their lives outside of Ireland, there probably could be a book about Irish writers in exile. Joyce Beckett, O'Brien, Colin McCann, Colm Tóibín, and we can go on and on and on.
I think that is true. I think probably Joyce would be thought of, and Beckett indeed, both of them who lived in Paris.
And Beckett wrote in French as much as he wrote in English.
Indeed he did. But they probably are thought of as not having really left Ireland. You know, they
were forced out at the time.
They were forced out and they moved away. But, you know, Joyce said, when I die, the word Dublin would be written on my heart. So in a certain way, they do have the presence in the country.
On the other hand, someone like J.P. Dunleavy has lived in Ireland longer than many of the Irish-born writers, and he is not included because he's an American writer?
Well, it was a very difficult exclusion, and finally, that was one place where the lens moved because I thought of him as somewhat that hybrid.
And Margaret, Carlos Fuentes, he lives mostly in Europe, doesn't he? So
well, many of the people that I included are very cosmopolitan. But if you ask, I translated Fuentes and I translate Allende, who is not, they both have exactly the same attitude. I dream in Spanish. I count in Spanish. I have sex in Spanish. Therefore, I write in Spanish. It's there. It's still in them.
And then someone like García Márquez, who lives in Mexico, he's still a Colombian writer.
He still is a Colombian writer.
So what kinds of guidelines did you give the editors, Edward? Were there any? being born there or living there? Or did the majority of their work have to deal with the country they came from?
We left it totally up. We're leaving it. We are, because, you know, we have a lot of other books in the works. We're leaving it totally up to the editors to decide what constitutes Irish writing or what constitutes Polish writing, what constitutes the dialogue, what is an Irish writer. We just thought, and also we decided to leave it to the editors so that, say, the Mexican writers on writing can span the whole history of the country, even before the history, whereas the Polish volume begins in the 20th century.
That's Adam Zagajewski.
That's Adam Zagajewski's book, and the Irish book begins with Yeats and Lady Gregory. We think it's most stimulating to let the editors decide where the conversation is most usefully begun in their own country. The other thing you're bringing up, which I think is really interesting, is we're finding this in country after country, that there's a conversation going on in the country and also outside the country. Mm. And the conversation is in Poland, in the Polish example, for example. A lot of the conversation in Polish writing has to do with Miłosz and Miłosz writing back to Polish writers in Poland. But, of course, he was in exile first in France and then in the United States at Michigan and then in Berkeley. And yet he's writing a history of Polish literature and is a central figure. Mm-hmm. And part of the conversation in these literatures is about exile. And there's also a conversation of, is literature local or is it universal? Is Irish literature a local literature or is it a European literature? And there's a strong debate within Irish literature and all these literatures about, is Mexican writing, should it be entirely about Mexico, or does Mexico have a conversation with French surrealism and with Europe? And so I think that's part of the interesting thing about the conversation with these writers, is between writers who live in the country and writers who don't.
Well, even you also, in your preface, talking about this matter, you also refer to the Irish imagination. Do you see a specific Irish imagination that runs through all of this literature?
Yeah, I think, again, that's a very interesting question. I mean, the Irish imagination is a catchphrase, but I think in Ireland, I would certainly have felt that, you know, this was a state that built itself in the 20th century against a colonial presence. There are people who build a country, they fight for it and they make it, but there are also people who imagine it. And they are a very distinct entity in Ireland, the people who imagined Ireland before it was a state, and the people who used the name before it was a state. And I think it has been a strength of Irish writing that they imagined a country often at odds with the state.
And Margaret, in the case of Mexico, it was a colony, and then it was free, then it was conquered by the French.
Back and forth.
And back and forth, right? And yes. It's really also a 20th century country, isn't it?
It is. And I could have started there, but it interested me very much to begin before that. I think I mentioned to you in our first letter that there was so much upheaval in that country that I would, they were either proselytizing or conquering or something other than writing. But they're very much a part still of Spain, in a way, that's where they were formed. And then, as you say, you bring in the surrealists. They're also very European in a way, and now very North American in a way. But it was interesting to me to try to set that.
It is interesting when you look at the arts in general in Mexico, just how right. much more they looked to Europe than to their northern neighbor, as powerful and as important as the United States right. has been over those years.
You know what one of their presidents said? Poor Mexico, so near the United States. So, but they're very much influenced. There are more books probably published in translation from our literature, from our popular literature, than there are of their great writers.
My guests are two of the three editors of the first three books issued in a new series called The Writer's World, Margaret Sayers-Pedden, editor of the Mexican book, Evan Boland of the Irish book, and Edward Hirsch, who is the overall editor. I don't know how much you actually edited the books once they came to you. I'm assuming that once you made the decision to assign these books, you just trusted the people you gave the books.
I just turned it over, and I think some of the times I've had closer conversations with the editors about what they were doing, but I think I just left that up to the editors of the individual volumes.
Well, have you seen some common threads that have turned up in the volumes that you've gotten so far? I'm assuming there are more than the three that you've published.
Well, we only have three so far, but the others are in the works. We have a Hebrew Writers on Writing in the works, which is next. We have a Chilean Writers on Writing. We have an Italian and Spanish Writers on Writing. We have a lot of books that are coming out. I would say that the main thing that has come out in my mind is that in every country there seems to be a kind of debate between the freedom of the imagination and the brutalities of history, and that writers, especially in smaller countries, can't really escape the political climate or the historical situation in which they're writing. On the other hand, they don't want to really be servants to the state. They don't want socialist realism. They don't want to be forced to write a certain kind of way. And there's a kind of tug of war, I would say, between the historical calling, the nightmare from which what history is, and then the imagination and the beauty of imagination and the freedom of imagination to turn away from political realities to something else. And so far in each of the volumes, I've seen a kind of debate developing in the country between writers who think, no, we really need to address solidarity, or we really need to address the Irish Troubles, or we really need to address colonialism mm-hmm. in Mexico, versus other writers who go, no, we belong to the world. We have a continental tradition, and we need to free our literatures from these local problems.
But it's interesting that in all of the books so far, including the ones that are in the works, we've seen totalitarian periods and writers who've had to write for one reason or another, things that were considered unacceptable, whether it was because somebody like Joyce who was forced out because of religion, or whether it's Mexico where the revolution in the 20th century got rather repressive and anti-clerical.
Absolutely.
The exact Poland, of course, communist country. Italy had Mussolini. We can
That's
go
right.
on and on and on. All of these writers had to deal with writing in a way that sent out, that was able to communicate without getting them in trouble, or they had to leave.
Well, I think you're making a really good point, and one of the points of the series, I will say, is that Americans have somehow imagined that we're free from history. We've had a very poor historical consciousness. I mean, Henry Ford famously said that history is bunk. And I don't think you have that luxury if you come from a small country where, say, first you're taken over by the Nazis and then you're taken over by the Soviets. Or each of these countries has had its own powerful history. And therefore, the pressure upon the writers, who I believe, as Ezra Pound said, are the antennae of the race, the pressure upon the writers to think about these issues is really tremendous. And I think these writers from different countries also have a tremendous amount to teach American writers and also Americans about the place and the role and the struggle with historical circumstance in our own writing.
Do you see that in the writing? Do you see differences, for example, even in Irish writing during periods when writers were constrained as opposed to periods where, like today, where anything pretty much goes?
Yeah, I think what Eddie is saying is very true. I mean, you know, although it doesn't look quite like that, there are times in every literature when writers are conscripted. You know, they're conscripted to the situation. Something in the north of Ireland, something in you know, 1920 in Ireland. They may not wish to be conscripted, but a Sean O'Casey, you know, or a Michael Longley, or any of those people are taken over by the world that they live in and can't really walk away, you know. And I do think that happens. But I also would want to say that I think Irish literature, largely when you read it in this kind of a sequence, is a literature of resistance against sentimental views of Ireland and confining views of Ireland.
And is that one of the reasons that all of these books are laid out, arranged chronologically? Because we want to see how that thing plays out?
I think the conversation that develops grows increasingly subversive from writer to writer and decade to decade.
It's interesting that in Mexico, the case of Mexico, where there was quite a bit of repression for a while, writers came to live in exile because of the repression back home.
In Spain, that's true. And it enriched Mexican literature to a great degree. And though there might not have been, say, a military oppression, there have been periods in Mexico. I'll give you one example. Emilio Carballido, who's a playwright, he simply began to write myths rather than social plays and took characters from ancient history so he could say what he wanted to say, but could say, sorry, that isn't contemporary.
We're talking about writers writing about writing with Margaret Sarah Petten, Eben Boland, and Edward Hirsch. Mr. Hirsch is the overall editor of a new series called The Writer's World from Trinity University Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Edward Hirsch, the overall editor of a new series called The Writer's World, and the editors of two of the three books that have just been released as part of that series. We have Eben Boland, who is the editor of Irish Writers on Writing, and Margaret Sayers Petten, the translator, who is editor of Mexican Writers on Writing. The third volume is Polish Writers on Writing, which is edited by the great Polish poet Adam Zagajewski. Do you think that the fact that you're a translator, Margaret, gives you a different insight into literature than if you were a writer?
I can't answer that because I'm not a writer. People often ask me, do you have published novels? Do you have published poetry? And I say, some people write history, some people write poetry. I write translation.
But you must think about how writers differ when you're translating them and whether there is a Mexican way with the language that's different.
No, I don't think so.
It's only when people talk.
I try to read as much as I can by each writer because they have their own vocabulary and they have their own icons and they have... No, I can't answer your question.
Although Mexico is a country that has this rich pre-Columbian history, and
absolutely.
So there are all sorts of words that are Mayan,
yes,
that are Aztec, that are Zapotec,
very
that don't occur in
vocabulary.
Any of the Spanish. And also it even spells its name with an X, whereas the rest of the Spanish world would spell its name with a J.
And they use the X in Don Quixote, too.
Well, that's because it was a change somewhere down the line.
That's right.
What do you do even when you're not editing something like this? Are you a writer?
Yeah.
So do you think you have a different kind of insight? Is that one of the reasons that so many of these writers in this volume are talking about other writers? Roddy Doyle writes about John Millington Synge's The Playboy of the Western World, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very important when someone like Roddy Doyle takes a figure like Synge and... you know, talks about teaching the playboy, you know, when he teaches it in a school. I mean, I think that's one of the really strongest pieces in that book. It's a very lively, interesting piece about bringing a rural text into an urban school 70 years later.
Mm. But right, I once had a painting teacher, Ann Reinhardt, who said all art comes from art and that it's always a dialogue.
Sure.
And I suspect that has to be true of every national tradition.
Well, this was the idea. I mean, it turns out this is the idea of the books, that there is a kind of conversation, but we don't necessarily know what it is. And because a lot of the writers are not translated or because they're only published at home, we know the Irish example is a really strong one, I think, because a lot of Ivan's book is extremely funny. And one of the reasons it's so funny is because the story of Yeats and Lady Gregory in the National Theater is so powerful. It also leads to a kind of mockery or to a sort of satirical take on it. You want to say something about that?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that that continues this, you know, very strong, you know, powerful thread of resistance to these, you know, sort of subterranean, prescriptive images of Ireland.
It's interesting when you look at, when I look at the table of contents, of course I recognize many of the names of the writers, and some of them are just some of the most important writers even alive today. And yet there are others that I'm unfamiliar with, people like Tom Paulin, maybe I should know his work, or Michael Hartnett. But I don't know their work. Is that, are they famous in Ireland?
Well, I think that they are very much part of the conversation. Michael Hartnett, unfortunately, isn't alive. Tom Paulin,
he died very young.
He died very young. And so they're part of this continuous, rich, interesting conversation.
And then another writer like John Banville, I think of him as a British writer almost. So, and I guess with so many Irish writers living in England, like Edna O'Brien and others, there has to be some kind of a cross-fertilization there as well.
Sure. I think there's a big traffic, you know, between the two countries.
Go ahead,
May
Margaret.
I say that that was one of the greatest delights in my being able to do this book. You mentioned Pash, you mentioned Fuentes. But I think of all the, we live right next door to Mexico, and all the people we don't know. Are you familiar with José Emilio Pacheco, who's now the best poet in Mexico? Nobody knows who he is. And one welcomes the opportunity to introduce people to these fine writers.
In Mexico, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz is considered one of the great literary treasures. I doubt that many Americans know about her. Can you talk about her?
I would love to talk about her. She's a passion of mine. And it's annoying, actually, that when you step across the Rio Grande, She's on the 10,000 peso note. She passes through your hands 100 times when you're in Mexico, and you don't know who she is. She's quite the most fascinating woman ever born in this hemisphere, in all time. An incredible woman, and we need to know who she is. She's difficult.
Well, and Paz wrote a wonderful book about her.
I translated it.
Thought I'd give you the chance.
Thank you.
And that's because she was an early feminist, a woman whose thinking was ahead of her time?
Well, you know, she's quite before the fact, but she had the largest collection of musical instruments in the New World, the largest collection of medical tools. She had the largest library in the New World.
When are we talking about?
When?
Yes.
She was born, they're not sure, let's say 1651 and died in 1695.
So 17th century.
Yes, 17th century and very Baroque. That's why she's very difficult. She lapsed out of sight in Mexico for two centuries until the Germans became interested in the Baroque, and she was revived. But please do get to know her.
What about the Crack Manifesto?
That's interesting to me, and I'm much less familiar with it because when I was teaching, I taught all these works. But I found it very interesting as such a concrete movement. That hasn't been true since groups like the Contemporaneos, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century. Which century are we in? I lose track. We're in the 21st, aren't we?
And we don't have many literary movements these days. We don't have groups of people getting together and saying, let's issue a manifesto.
They were so conscious about what they were doing. I admire that.
You were going to say something, Ed. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that even part of our intuition about the series turns out to be true. That is, even the writers that we do know of, we read them out of context. And so you read Paz or you read Fuentes in a different way in the context of these other Mexican writers, the history of Mexican literature, that they're also in conversation with.
My guests are three people involved in a new series that is called The Writer's World. We're speaking with Edward Hirsch, Ivan Boland, and Margaret Sayers-Petten. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Ivan, what works did you include that deal with Irish politics and the Troubles?
Well, I think there were different stages of that. I mean, there's no doubt that the early part of the state's formation, I mean, even when people like Yeats and Lady Gregory are founding the theatre, they're referring to it. Northern Irish poetry, I think, is very obviously, you know, keyed into the Troubles. And I included a lot of that poetry, which is very good.
And what about poetry? I would think that that's where the different cultures are most distinctive because of the differences in the language. In the case of Irish poetry, I assume that it's not just English, which most of the poetry is written in, but Gaelic, a whole other sense of language that is unique to Ireland.
Yeah, I think a lot of the Gaelic tradition is layered like an amber into the English language poetry. And you know, there is a great deal about the Irish language in this book, but in English.
And what about Mexican poetry? Would it just be part of the great Spanish tradition?
Well, certainly it began there. There was very little poetry until 19th century. And I can't explain that other than everyone was so busy, as I say, conquering people and proselytizing and fighting revolutions that they didn't seem to write poetry. But it's very rich vein in the 20th century, as you know.
There is a consciousness of the United States in among Mexican poets. I know from an experience I had with Octavio Paz, who was here with Elliot Weinberger, and we were talking about one of his collections of poetry. And he said that he'd be published in Mexico, and then Elliot would do a translation of the poem, and he'd look at it and say, oh my, there's a major flaw in this poem that he only could see once it was translated.
Yes.
And then he'd go back to Mexico and say, you have to change this for the second edition, change the Spanish, and the second edition is Mexican. He said his publishers hated Elliot.
I bet they did. That's interesting. I've had that happen to me, that someone will read the English translation and say, my God, that character can't do that. And it's a question of objectivity and distance, I suppose.
And the poem by Seamus Dean touches on the Irish landscape and Irish history. How is that poem about writing?
I think it's about arrival. I haven't it here in front of me, but I think the poem is about the place of returning to a landscape that is, you know, toxic in certain ways. I don't think politics needs to be an explicit agenda in a poem for the poem to be very political. And I think a lot of the Irish writing that is about place and about the encroachment on a sense of place is in fact political writing.
In the case of Mexico, we don't think of it as a melting pot, but Mexico sure is. And one of the poets here could just as easily, I mean, one of the writers here is Polish-Mexican. Another one is Ilan Stavan. Is it Stavan?
Stavans.
Who writes about being both Mexican and Jewish.
He's an immigrant, I suppose one would say. But he's really a creature of the cosmos, I think. It is questionable. Get back to the point of the question, which I just lost because I was thinking of Elon, please.
I was talking about some countries. For example, Ireland has a unified sensibility.
Yes.
But Mexico, like the United States, you could just as easily have a lot of hyphenates.
It is, first of all, it's the country that is most blended in India, Indian and white and black. And so to that degree, you get someone writing in Maya still. I know people who still write in Maya.
You don't translate those.
I do not translate Maya. But their influences came mostly from Europe, I would say.
Ed, you mentioned Italy. Where else? What else is on the line?
The very next book is going to be Hebrew Writers on Writing. And, I mean, it's very much germane to what you're talking about because Peter Cole, the editor, has discovered all kinds of writers in Hebrew who aren't only in Israel, who are also writing in Hebrew from different countries. And there you have a kind of dialogue with biblical tradition, but also with current national politics and the Jews in Israel, Jews outside of Israel, what writing is, what the role of writing is. And then we also have a Chilean book is coming next. We have an Italian book edited by Jay Perini. We have a Spanish book edited by Christopher Moore and so forth and so on.
Can we say that in some countries the role of the writer is more powerful than others? Some countries, the writers become national celebrities. In the United States, they become celebrities among the reading public, but little else.
I would say that almost everywhere else in the world, the writer has a much more significant place than in the United States.
And why do you think that is?
I think that, I'm not exactly sure.
I mean, Mario Vargas Llosa writes novels and then runs for president of Peru.
This is especially true of poets, where poetry is part of the national conversation almost everywhere else in the world. And it's a great agony to me that it's not here in the United States. I think that poetry has a tremendous part to do, and literature has a tremendous part to do in the formation of a national consciousness in different countries. And partly the formation of that consciousness puts poetry and literature itself at the center of what defines what it is to be Irish or what it is to be Polish or what it is to be Mexican.
And since you're a poet, I'm sure.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
Something that bothers you a lot.
So is Ivan. So we're proselytizing on this particular.
There you are.
We have very little time, but you wanted to add something?
Just very, very briefly. That Mexico sends its ambassadors and its cultural attachés. They're all writers.
It's really true. Yes.
All writers.
The Mexican consul in Dublin is a writer.
Yeah, well, Carlos Fuentes
Paz resigned his ambassadorship in India during the revolution in 1968.
I think our political landscape would be much healthier if our writers were part of this national conversation.
Well, I can think of some poets I wouldn't mind being in politics, and others that probably be scare the heck out of me.
I'm with you there.
Edward Hirsch, Ivan Boland, and Margaret Serres will be joined by Adam Zagajewski to discuss the series Writers on Writing at 7 o'clock tonight at NYU. You can find out more about this on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.